This is the Untold Civil War podcast, and if you've been keeping up with our episodes, you'll know that I served in the 69th New York as an infantryman. During that time, I met a bunch of interesting characters. My first team leader was a sergeant originally from Ukraine who had served in the Soviet Marines, Israeli commandos, and then of course the US military. He was the type of man who led a soldiering life, and he was not the first of his kind. Soldiers of fortune, career warriors have served in the military as far back as the American Civil War, and those are the men we'll be talking about today. But before we get started, just know that this episode will also be featured in two parts on YouTube. The first will be on Lord Rivers, our guest's channel, and the second will be on our channel. So if you prefer to watch this discussion with visuals, please check out the links in the show notes. And now, have your bed nurse turn up the volume, forget the woes of cholera, and let's delve into some untold civil war. Here we are, another episode on the Untold Civil War podcast, and I am again with one of our favorite guests, Lord Rivers, and we're going to be talking about Soldiers of Fortune in the Civil War. Thank you for coming on the podcast yet again. Really appreciate having you here.
Thanks for having me. We get to talk about some untold civil war and some actually really interesting figures. Any of these people I would love to have met, and I'm glad we get to tell their stories today.
Absolutely. So if we could just start it off, what is a soldier? First of all, the definition, what is a soldier of fortune? What are we looking at here?
Well, I think it has a lot of negative connotations to some people that they're, you know, mercenaries that are working, for whatever army will hire them. For a lot of these people, though, they are professional soldiers, and when there is no war in their country, it doesn't even faze them to go sign up to fight for another country, whoever else needs professional soldiering. It does get looked down upon at the time. There are some interesting comments from people about soldiers of fortune, about mercenaries, but at the end of the day, they are professional soldiers going to apply their trade in whatever conflict is brewing around the world.
And I guess you could definitely say that one of these professional soldiers is Garibaldi. Now, does he come to the Civil War? Is there a story about that?
So Garibaldi is such an interesting figure. He began his career in Italy, but then goes to South America to fight. Is heavily involved in the revolutions in South America, a failed revolution in Brazil, and then a successful liberation of Uruguay. He leads this revolution in Rome and is very important in the First Italian War of Independence. In 1859, he leads the Cacciatori delle Alpi in northern Italy, and then he has the famous Red Shirts, which I'll talk about later. He is a celebrity. He is a military celebrity. Everyone knows him. He's not just a soldier of fortune, though. He is usually in it for the cause. And he is one of the great liberators, one of the great freedom fighters of the mid-19th century. And so people are wondering whether Garibaldi, the celebrity general, might involve himself in the Civil War. Garibaldi actually sends a letter to Lincoln offering his services. Of course, he would only like to be the commander-in-chief, and he would prefer that Lincoln immediately free the slaves to make clear that it is a struggle for that rather than dancing around the subject. Of course, that's rejected, but as for interesting historical possibilities, any alternate histories, that would have been profoundly interesting to see Garibaldi.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Serving in America. Now, that's a whole conversation for a different day of what he would have done.
Right.
I think he's a very much a bayonet charge sort of guy, and he's not a professional in the way that a lot of the Crimean War experienced officers mm-hmm. are. It might have been even more bloody. Who knows?
Right.
Definitely could have happened. And there were people that were actively trying to recruit Garibaldi. And there were people that were working for Garibaldi trying to spread his name around in the U.S. So there were people trying to make it happen. It just didn't happen.
It didn't happen, but many similar gentlemen with similar talents and similar backgrounds definitely chose to come through to the Civil War, to the United States to serve in the Civil War. And so let's talk about some of their motivations as well.
As for motivations, I mean, we'll talk about the different figures that we've chosen, but there are myriad motivations. There are, true believers in the cause on both sides. There are people that are clearly in it just for the money. It is just another war, another day, another war. There are people that, have personal connections to one side or the other. So, like any situation, there's going to be a lot of different motivations. For most of the figures that I've chosen, I think they're professionals and they're not true believers.
Right. Okay. Well, why don't you lead us off? Talk about some of the first people you've chosen.
I think we have to start with my favorite figure. He is just a very, very interesting figure. I've talked about him all the time. Anybody that knows me knows I talk about Sir Percy Wyndham. Had these giant whiskers, and his men would always get nervous when he started twirling his whiskers. He got very angry. But for interesting mid-19th century characters, figures, he just has such a repertoire of events. He's like Forrest Gump, or he's everywhere in that mid-19th century context. So he, in 1848, he joins the French Navy. He's an Englishman, joins the French Navy just for some experience, accepts a commission in the British Army, and then after gaining some experience with the cavalry, goes and works for the Austrians. I guess he wasn't going to progress enough in the British Army, and goes and works for the Habsburgs, and is in a Lancer regiment, ends up commanding a Lancer regiment in Austrian service until 1860. And then, and this is another one of those questions where the soldier of fortune issue comes up of, is it very uncouth to not only switch to a different army, but go to the other side?
Ah, yes.
Because he joins Garibaldi in 1860, and he actually becomes a lieutenant colonel in Garibaldi's red shirts. So that's not the regular Piedmontese army. It's not the Northern Italian army. It's volunteers under Garibaldi in Sicily and in Calabria that are fighting to overthrow the Bourbon Kingdom of the Two Sicilies down there. So from 1860 to 61, he's on the other side and fighting for Garibaldi. And there he makes a bunch of connections. In fact, he, is a personal contact with Garibaldi. He meets Chatham Roberto Wheat, who I didn't put on the list. But he's just as interesting. I think Sir Percy Wyndham is so much more interesting than Wheat. But Wheat, of course, is one of Garibaldi's red shirts, and then goes and forms the Louisiana Tigers. And he actually meets Sir Percy when Sir Percy is captured, and he runs over to him and says, "Percy, old boy." And they have a moment when Sir Percy is not in his best moment, because I'm skipping ahead here, but Sir Percy gets captured along with most of his regiment at one point in the war. That's with him when he's with the 1st New Jersey. And so all of these soldiers of fortune, a lot of them have these connections with each other.
Right. It's a small circle, Yeah, if you've been fighting all these different wars, you're bound to bump into one another.
Yeah.
Once, twice, maybe more than that.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you're fighting against each other, sometimes you're fighting with each other. So
yeah. And so Sir Percy, this is kind of where I get my Lord Rivers thing from, is where Sir Percy called himself Sir because he had been given an Italian knighthood. He had the Military Order of Savoy, and he had been given that, very proud of it, but of course it wasn't actual English knighthood. And so everyone finds him incredibly pretentious for using Sir Percy, but I think it's great.
Absolutely.
Yeah. He has such an interesting career, and when we get after the Civil War, I will read his obituary, which is just as fantastical as the rest of his life.
On that note, I'd like to say that although he did serve with Garibaldi, there were other soldiers of fortune who were actually on the other side. So not every soldier of fortune were on the Garibaldi side.
So you have one?
I do have one.
Wow.
I have one character that I like. His name's Miles Keough.
Yes.
And I know that people may know him from the movie, I believe They Died With Their Boots On, right, with Errol Flynn, about the 7th Cavalry.
They talk so much about onions in that movie that I call that onion movie. I have no idea why, but they're creamed onions.
Yes. Where they got that, I don't know.
I don't know either. I would like to know.
But Miles Keough definitely is portrayed in that movie as sort of this happy-go-lucky Irishman who actually introduces the song Gary Owen to the 7th Cavalry. I don't know if that's true at all. I will say that he was actually known to be quite depressing, morose. He really wasn't that happy and go lucky. But he did start out his career. He was born to a well-to-do Catholic family from County Carlow. And when he was 20 years old, he left for Italy to join Pope Pius IX in his fight against Garibaldi's revolutionaries. He became a member of the Battalion of St. Patrick, and despite being issued poor uniforms and weaponry, they served courageously. And for their service, the men, including Keough, were presented with medals by the Pope, which is something I'll get to because it's sort of a good luck charm later in his career when fighting Indians. But of course, he would then, as the fighting wind down, he would stay in the Papal Army and serve as a member in their Irish Zouave company until he heard about rumors and the Civil War happening across the pond and more adventure to be had. So he too would make his way to the American continent.
Yeah, the Papal Army is really interesting because of the fact that it collects volunteers from all over the Catholic world. So, I always think that they're full of really interesting characters. There's one character, one of my favorite historical figures of all time, other than Sir Percy Wyndham, is Washington Carroll Tevis. And it's actually an American. Fascinating that I actually like an American figure. but he's really interesting because he ends up serving the Pope after the Civil War. But he begins his career, goes to West Point, starts training with the cavalry in the U.S., and then inherits a bunch of money. So what do you do when you inherit a bunch of money? You leave the army and you go to Paris. Obviously, that's what you do in the 19th century.
Why not?
So he goes and jaunts around Paris for quite a bit and actually ends up at the beginning of the Crimean War accepting a commission as a binbashi, cavalry officer in the Ottoman service.
Wow.
That's out of left field. Actually having an American who's recently been living in France go work for the Turks.
Right.
And he actually distinguishes himself. He becomes a colonel in the Bashi Bazouks and fights in one of the lesser known theaters of the Crimea, not actually on the Crimean Peninsula, but over near the siege of Kars in the Caucasus and eastern Anatolia. And he ends up fighting, becomes a general in the Civil War. And then after he goes and after working for the Fenians, for the Fenian Brotherhood, goes and serves the Pope. And I forgot to mention, he did convert to Catholicism in 1853. May or may not have been for a girl in Paris, but he does that. And so that's his connection to the Fenians and the Papal States.
It's interesting you bring that up because I have another character. When you're talking about going to Paris, right, there have been many many ne'er-do-wells or soldiers of fortune that do end up going to Paris to look for employment with none other than the French Foreign Legion, right, the home to all of these soldiers of fortune. Konstantin Blandowski, I know I might be butchering that Polish name there, but he actually was, he was a soldier all his life, and he got his start early on serving in the French Foreign Legion in Algiers. And after serving with them, he would go serve in the uprisings in 1846 in Krakow among the Polish patriots. And as everything continues, all these revolutions through 1848, he ends up joining the Hungarian army in the 3rd Uhlan Regiment. So he too started out in France and branched out.
That's what I really like about all of these figures is that, you know, they have that connection to the Civil War, which we all really enjoy learning about, but it gives you a window into all the other events in the mid-19th century. Most people that study the Civil War might not know about the 1848 revolutions and how they were so important to everyone living in Europe at the time. But through all these figures, you get to see other rabbit holes that you go down to research.
Oh, right. Absolutely. And it's true, because when you look at these, like the 1848 revolutions and the other things that are happening in other parts of the world, you sort of get into that perspective of not just the soldiers of fortune, but the average immigrants who were in the United States at the time serving, and how they sort of viewed their world and how they understood the cause and what the cause was to them. It all goes back to how they were raised and what they witnessed back in the old country.
And I think everybody talks about the Irish Brigade, which is, of course, super important to talk about.
Right.
As an Irish person, I can't disparage the Irish Brigade. Two other ones that are important is the Garibaldi Guard, of course, which is the reason I bring it up now, is it's hugely comprised of Hungarians. A huge amount of Hungarians in the Garibaldi Guard. And a lot of them have that experience from 48. And then, of course, most of the units in 11th Corps, in the European brigades, a lot of them have that 1848 service. And that's not to say that they're professional soldiers. They might have combat experience, but they might not have that technical expertise. But it is interesting to have that 1848 connection.
Right. And I think I read somewhere that the German Dutch immigrant percentage in the armies was actually larger than the Irish.
Probably.
Yeah.
I don't have the statistics on that, but there are a lot in both on both sides too.
For sure. Yeah. And of course, we're talking about the 1848 revolutions and some of those motivations for some of these people to come to the United States. One of my characters that I find very interesting is Prince Felix Konstantin Alexander Johann Nepomuk of Salm. He is a really interesting guy, and he actually served in the Prussian military, the Austrian military, eventually the Union, finally the Imperial Army of Mexico, which we'll get to.
Yes.
And he's actually, in name, he is actually of noble birth. So I was actually able to find an article here written by his wife, which sort of talks about why these nobles and 48ers came to the United States to serve during the Civil War. So I'm just going to read that real quick for our listeners. It is astonishing how many German noblemen found it necessary to go out of the way of European difficulties and seek a refuge in the United States. The Prussian and Austrian army furnished a considerable contingent of shipwrecked officers who mostly had to run away before their creditors, or who escaped the consequences of some duel, breach of discipline, if not some less pardonable sins. The salt water flowing between Europe and America was, however, supposed to wash off all European impurities. Nobody cared how one had sinned in the old country, as long as he behaved in a manner which was thought proper in America. New York and other large cities were teeming with characters of that kind, and their position before the war had been a very precarious one. Their military knowledge was not of the slightest use to them in America. Then the social prejudices, pretensions, and views which they brought with them were the principal impediments to their success. Many perished miserably because they could not renounce them. Others only commenced to get on with the direst necessity had compelled them to work. Those acted most wisely who at once resolved to earn their living in in whatever honest manner, not concerning whether their occupation was in accordance with the position they had held in Europe. Work does not dishonor in America, but a life of idleness does. The revolutions of 1848 and 49 brought numbers of refugees from Germany to America. They were found not only in the cities of the East, but almost everywhere in the United States. And it cannot be denied that this immigration had a great and, I think, salutary influence on the German element in America. For amongst these refugees were many distinguished men, though also a great number of blackguards, who were always to be found in the wake of revolutions. New York especially was crowded with this latter class of people. The outbreak of the war was a godsend to most of the shipwrecked Germans, especially those from Prussia, as all of them had been soldiers, and even the most imperfect knowledge of military things was then of the highest value to the Americans, who understood nothing at all of them. In the land of the blind and the one-eyed is king, Prussian corporals became high officers, and those who understood how to strike the iron whilst it was red hot could rise to the highest military honors. The military chiefs of the German Revolution, whose importance and military talents were greatly exaggerated and mostly overrated by their countrymen, rose at once to high places, as the American government acknowledged the military rank they had held in the Revolution, as had been done also in England at the breaking out of the Crimean War. So she didn't really have a great view of all of them. But it is interesting. Yes, it is interesting to say that Prince Felix, who she ends up marrying, is one of these gentlemen who, although he knew plenty about fighting, he ends up fighting in the first Schleswig War. Excuse me if I'm pronouncing. Yes. And receiving a sword of honor from the King of Prussia and the Austro-Sardinian War. However, he wasn't as good with money. And because of his certain debts, he did end up running to America, according to her writings. So.
Yeah, I think we talked about the second Schleswig War last episode because the eye of Parliament shifts away from the American Civil War over to the Schleswig crisis because a war with Prussia and Denmark is much more likely to upset the balance of power of Europe than some squabble in America. But yeah, that's a fascinating look into the blackguards of 48.
Yes, so you have a lot of these trained military personnel who are in the Americas, who are fond of duels, fond of fighting, and need a job. What's interesting about Prince Felix is that he basically knew no English, and he even admitted that himself. And so
when did he arrive in America?
I believe he arrived. I'll have to double check. I think the war when he arrived, McClellan was already in command, I believe.
Oh, okay. So he wasn't there ahead of time.
No, not ahead of time. Okay. I believe when he arrived, McClellan was already in command. At least he was already looking for a command when McClellan was around. And he does end up, well, they offered him a command. He said no because he was afraid his English wasn't good enough. But as we mentioned before, there are plenty of Germans in the Union Army. And so they soon found a position for him as a colonel in one of these regiments. And first the 8th New York.
So I have three more figures I have to talk about or I have to introduce before the war begins.
Oh, yes, let's go ahead.
I don't know how many you have left. But I'm going to go with the next one, since we're talking about the French. I think Polignac is very interesting. The Confederates obviously had a hard time pronouncing his name, so they called him Prince Polcat.
Yeah.
So Prince Polcat started his career as a French officer in the Crimea, and he was just a lieutenant in the Crimea, continues in the French service, and then comes to the Confederate States during the Civil War and actually rises to become a major general. And he's apparently the last major general to die after the war, major general. Fairly young general and brings that professionalism. He serves in the Franco-Prussian War after the Civil War. But he has this air of professionalism that he brings to his command, at least. And he certainly has a memorable name with Prince Polcat.
Yes.
The two other ones I'm going to mention, of course, I can't do anything without mentioning my favorite book, A World on Fire, Amanda Foreman's giant tome on Britain and the American Civil War. And along with Sir Percy, the one she talks about quite a bit as for British soldiers in foreign service, it's Henry Fielden. And Henry Fielden first joined the Black Watch. He actually comes from a military family. He was born in Kildare. He's an Englishman, but he was born in County Kildare, which is near the barracks for a lot of cavalry units, because a lot of horses come from Kildare. My family in Ireland is from Kildare town in Kildare, so I've been over to Kildare many times. There's a large military museum there now, actually, and it's still a proving ground. It's still a training area for the Irish Army. They even have a cannon from the Crimean War there. But his father was in the 17th Lancers. He ends up joining the Black Watch, is involved in the Indian Mutiny, the suppression of the mutiny and the Indian Rebellion. And then he fights at the Taku Forts in China. So he's been all over the world. And then he goes and joins Confederate service, is recommended by some of his friends. Everybody has those connections. And he ends up being adjutant to Johnston. But a lot of his interesting things happen after the war. But Henry Fielden, very interesting. And you can read a lot of his.
He does meet Fremantle, right?
Yeah.
Fremantle, I think. Yeah.
And I Fremantle deserves his own episode.
Yeah.
But he does meet Fremantle at some point. It seems like any time Englishmen are around in the war, the Confederates or actually both sides go out of their way to introduce them to the other Englishmen. Hey, you're English. You know this guy? Hey. And there are a bunch of those little vignettes, especially Percy, old boy.
Yes.
But the last figure I'm going to talk about is William Loring. And he isn't a soldier of fortune until after the war. And so I'll talk about him a little later. But he actually serves in Mexico, rises to be a major. And so at the beginning of the war, he's kind of a big deal in the Confederate Army, becomes a major general in the Confederate Army, and actually outranks Lee for a time, or at least as disdainful of Lee, who actually gets sent to observe Loring's command at one point. And so he kind of sees it as Richmond overstepping, but he has that prior service, but he will have a much more interesting career abroad than he does in the in Confederate service. So that's all my characters introduced. Do you have any more?
I just have one more.
Okay.
And again, just like Loring, he doesn't really have a soldiering career at the start. So his name's actually George DuPont, and he's unique because he comes from Siam. Mm. So if we talk about sort of interesting what ifs, if anyone's seen the movie The King and I, they'll know that the King of Siam did offer Lincoln some elephants.
Yes.
For his army.
Yeah.
Lincoln did not accept this offer. I actually have the quote here real quick. I think he explains that in the United States, steam as on land and water is really their best and most efficient agent of transportation, and that elephants just wouldn't cut it really in the U.S. climate. So the U.S. didn't get elephants from Siam, but they did get George DuPont, which I think is an interesting character in and of himself. He started out as a type founder in the United States. He comes over and he has that regular civilian job until he has to enlist in Company B on the 13th New Jersey when the Civil War finally breaks out. We can get into his experience in the Civil War.
So he's
an
American or he's Thai?
So that's something they're not sure about. The only thing that they're able to find is that in his enlistment records, he does have those Thai features. Dark hair, dark eyes, right? But okay, there's no image of him. They don't know if he was an American over there that came back, or, you know, son of missionaries there, or who knows. But they do know that in his enlistment records, he does have Thai features. That's about it. There's no picture yet found of him. Well, so that would be interesting.
We don't know.
Yeah.
So with a lot of things with this, I kind of get reminded of what I talk about when I portray von Steuben, when I'm shaven. In the 1770s, there's no shortage of gentlemen that think they would be great at running an army and are willing to accept a commission and some pay. And so there are a lot of volunteers for American service in the 1770s. And it was Franklin, you know, in the American delegation's job to kind of sift through that. And when they first meet von Steuben, they say, no, thanks. There were so many amateurs that had come over. And so it's only with a little resume fudging that Franklin and the delegation agree to let von Steuben go over. And it was hard to convey that. I mean, they say he was a major general and he was a lieutenant general in the Austrian service. And they really fluffed up his resume. But it was hard to convey this guy's a real professional soldier. Just because he's a captain doesn't mean he doesn't know. He personally studied with Frederick the Great. He was his father was an engineer officer and was important at the Siege of Prague. He lives and breathes the professional military. And so it's the same situation, 4 score and 7 years later, when you have all these foreign volunteers coming over, and it's hard to tell, are these guys real professionals or are they amateurs looking for glory? And I think for most of the people that I've chosen, they are professionals and they're not just amateurs looking for glory. There are, when it comes to Loring, I think he is an amateur and I think he went looking for glory elsewhere. But for instance, with Sir Percy, he was a real professional cavalryman. He had his men train with the saber, and everyone kind of scoffed at it at the time. They still scoff at it now. But in one of his major engagements at Brandy Station, in a thoroughfare gap, they use their sabers. And at Brandy Station, when he's commanding a brigade, he has the famous charge against Jeb Stuart's positions, and they aren't successful, but they do catch Stuart by surprise and kind of lift the veil on the mystique of Stuart. But my favorite quote from that engagement is that some Confederates shout at them and say, draw your pistols and fight like gentlemen. and it's kind of the opposite of what you would normally
You wouldn't expect
a gentlemanly thing to do, but they were in such close quarters that the pistols and carbines weren't effective, and he was just interested in getting in close, fight with your saber, and if they actually knew what they were doing, they were quite deadly with the saber, and his men greatly respected him after that, and that kind of gets Sir Percy back from the doldrums of him having been captured because dash and fire doesn't always work. Sometimes you run into a trap and your whole regiment gets captured, but sometimes, you know, with the appropriate training, the men really can benefit from real professional soldiering. And I think that was a great example of a professional. Now, I've talked about it on my channel with Brett. Brett has his books about it, but musketry is also a huge thing. And in British service, at least, and this gets proven with basically anyone that was a British infantry officer, the capability of the rifle musket is insane, is really impressive if it's used correctly. If it's not used correctly, you do, you know, what they did in the American Civil War, which is come within 200 yards of each other and slog it out. But with the actual understanding of the capabilities, the ability to judge distance, the ability to judge your trajectory of your rounds, a professional soldier can fire his company, fire a regiment out to 1,000 yards. And Fielgen, you know, when he was fighting at the Taku forts, they used long-range fire to pin down enemy position while infantry advanced under that fire. And so the professionalism element really is interesting to me, that they had a lot of stuff to offer, and I think that elevates a lot of these people to professional soldier over soldier of fortune.
Right.
That's my defense of Sir Percy. He did nothing wrong.
Right. And I think if we go further into that, at least for one of my characters, my Polish character, Bandowski, there is an image of him. I can send it to you. I'll put it on my Instagram, but I can send it to you as well, that people can actually take a look at him. But not only is he a professional, it's interesting you mentioned the sword thing, because when he comes to the United States, he becomes a master fencer for one of the German sports clubs. And another thing about him is that he actually ends up giving his life for this cause very early on. So at the Cap Jackson affair, which was essentially what happened was a pro-secession militia had mustered just out St. Louis, where St. Louis, Missouri, where there was a federal arsenal. Sumter had already taken place, but prior to Sumter and just after Sumter, there was a pattern of this where secession militia were basically capturing and taking control of federal arsenals and fortifications. So those Union troops commanded by Nathaniel Lyon knew that their arsenal was in jeopardy. So they went out to arrest this secession militia, which they did successfully, and were escorting them back through town when a drunk man, according to the writings of Sherman, who was actually there with his son, not famous yet, a drunk man drew a revolver and began firing at the soldiers. He states an officer was shot in the leg and chaos ensues, essentially, and that officer was Blandowski. Blandowski is actually mortally wounded. I've heard reports that the shot, maybe for the drunk man with the revolver, I've also heard that it might have been from friendly fire by accident. There's also the story that he was the one who actually ordered the soldiers to fire as he fell, but none of that has been substantiated. Ultimately, though, his wound proves mortal, and he passes away on May 25th, which is interesting because had he passed away earlier, he may have been remembered as the first Union officer killed in the conflict. Instead, that honor went to Elmer Ellsworth, who died a day earlier. So technically, you could say maybe he was the first mortally wounded officer of the war. But when they came here, they had professional skills. And you could argue that in this case, maybe a lot of these guys did believe enough of the cause to be willing to risk their lives out there. And Blandowski actually give his life for the cause that he believed in for the North.
Isn't it depressing when you research these people and get really attached to them and keep reading the story and then they die when you don't expect?
Yes, so early on, that was it.
Yeah, I actually had a figure that I had discovered before in passing, passing reference, but it was very depressing because I have such a connection to this guy. And only 2 days ago, I figured out this connection. Bradford Smith Hoskins, he's not, you know, the flashy, exciting figure that is in my list here, but he actually was in the 44th. And, you know, anybody that knows me, that's the unit I portray for the Crimean War and then for post-Crimea. It's not a dashing unit. We actually chose it because it was a just a regular line infantry unit, and it's the most massacred regiment in the British Army. But Bradford Smith Hoskins served in Crimea, actually ended up fighting with Garibaldi too. So he would have known Sir Percy, and he would have known Wheat, and all of these interesting people. And then he goes and fights with Mosby. And for anybody that knows Mosby's Rangers, they're a tough crowd. And apparently he still wore his red uniform, his British uniform, while everyone in this ragtag bunch is galloping around. And he actually dies in Virginia with Mosby at his side. You can see his grave. There's only one very grainy picture I've found of him. But it's very sad when you find the tragic deaths in history. It's an interesting connection that you feel when you do that.
Yeah, recently. Absolutely. Absolutely, yeah. And of course, death is on both sides as well. It's not just the soldiers of fortune who are being killed, but for example, my character Miles Keough, who ends up coming to the United States after serving in the Papal Army. He serves in the Union Army as a cavalryman. He survives Antietam, survives Fredericksburg, Gettysburg, Randy Station, and he actually becomes a favorite of General John Buford, who was played by Sam Elliott in the movie Gettysburg.
Yes, on the high ground.
Yes, the high ground. He served on Buford's staff, and when Buford died after contracting what some would say is typhoid, it's said that he was being held in Keough's arms at the time. So these guys, they develop relationships with their fellow brothers in arms, even though they weren't necessarily born and raised Americans or originally dedicated to the cause of the Union. You know, they came here as soldiers of fortune, but that didn't stop them from building those relationships and those ties.
And at first meeting, a lot of these snooty European professional soldiers don't come off very well to the American soldiers. And most of them that I read do earn that respect as the war progresses. And they come to understand their funny speaking professional soldiers in the army.
But how do some of your characters fare during the war?
So during the war, we talked about Sir Percy. We talked about Henry Fielden. He's actually at the surrender. Polignac makes it out. Nevis Bay makes it out. Loring makes it out. I think that's all of my characters. I pick people that survived.
One of my characters has already, didn't make it to the end of the podcast here. Prince Felix, he does make it out. He does serve in the American Civil War, and he does make it out. Not only does he make it out, but he is offered a commission in the regular army after the war, which wasn't offered quite often.
That's a big deal.
Yeah, which he actually turns down and chooses to go help Emperor Maximilian in the issue across the border.
Bold move. Was it the right one? I don't know.
Yeah, which we could get into. DuPont, of course, he enlists in Company B of the 13th New Jersey. He serves in Antietam, Chancellorsville, Gettysburg. He actually becomes a victim of the most common threat in warfare, disease, recovers. He serves in Reseca, where he receives his first real red badge of courage. It was only a slight wound, but again, he would be wounded at the Battle of Culp's Farm, and he would be ultimately discharged in 1865, where he would return to his life as a type founder before he finds that life too restless after serving in the military, and he must find something else to do.
Yeah.
There's also talk that he may have been on the wrong side of the law at the same time. And Miles Keough, same thing. He survives the war, and he is offered command in the regular army. Again, very rare honor, especially when they're downsizing. And he even says it, when all the great volunteer army is scattered to the winds, I am among few selected to be retained in the regular army. He was very proud of that. And as seen in the Civil War, he was always in the middle of the action, and he would end up in the fateful 7th Cavalry on its expedition towards the Little Bighorn.
Wow, that's interesting. Just like the movie.
Yes, just like the movie.
A completely historically accurate movie.
There you go. It has to be. Has to be now. Everything's adding up.
They all sang songs and ate onions. It was great.
Yeah. So what happens to some of your characters as the war ends
I'm going to talk about the one with immediate implications. Washington Carroll Tevis starts working for the Fenians, the Fenian Brotherhood. They're Irish nationalists that are planning an attack on British Canada, hoping that they're going to get that, if not official American support, at least American volunteers for this attack on British Canada in hopes of freeing Ireland. Actually ends up being a brigadier general for the Fenians, starts training them, is very involved in the planning stages, and we now know he was working for the British the whole time.
Yeah.
He received £100 a month to pass them information, and I bet that had something to do with their failures.
Maybe a little bit.
Yeah,
he's a real James Bond secret agent kind of character
here. Soldier of Fortune. I don't know if this guy's on the top of the list for honorable. he was working for the Fenian Brotherhood and had been, even though he was a Catholic, was passing information to the British the entire time, we now know.
Everyone has their price, I guess.
Yes. So then he goes and works for the Papal Army, becomes distinguished in training volunteers for the Papal Army. And of course, they get completely ready for a big fight because Southern Italy had fallen in 1860, fighting until 1862. But there was the Papal States before the Vatican, the micro state of the Vatican was formed. The Papal States actually basically controlled all of central Italy. And it wasn't until until the Franco-Prussian War that the Italians actually moved in on the Papal States, because Napoleon III, being the preeminent Catholic ruler, actually gave his promise to the Pope that Papal territory would be sovereign and France would defend it. And so immediately when France surrenders to Prussia, the regular Italian army starts moving in on Rome. At that point, Washington Carroll Tevis had already moved on. He was called Nevis Bey by the Ottomans, so I always remember him by Nevis Bey, so I have to think about Washington Carroll Tevis. But he actually ends up working for the French in the Franco-Prussian War, commanding, I believe, a division in the Franco-Prussian War after training the Papal States, and then goes and works for the Egyptians, which I'll save for the last. But such an interesting guy, actually gets Order of St. Ferdinand. He wears a bunch of different noble order stars, has all, I'll put up the picture of him in his full dress uniform after the war, because it's quite the sight.
I don't know if it's appropriate now, but I just feel like I have to end my story with Miles Keough here, because you do mention the medals and decorations. That is a Miles Keough story right there. Like I mentioned before, he did receive medals when serving under the Pope, and he actually kept these. He was very proud of them. He kept them on his person. It was said that he kept one of them in a little leather pouch tied around his neck, and he was wearing them during the campaign of the Little Bighorn. What's interesting about him is, I mean, the battle itself is very interesting and is probably a topic for another podcast, I guess. On, you know, maybe I'll start a new pod, Untold Frontier or something. But and as far as I know, it's the only battlefield on which there are markers for where everyone fell. So even though we don't have firsthand accounts from the cavalry side, at least from the Custer column, to say what happened at the battle, because most they were all massacred to a man, we can sort of get a sort of interpretation of those cavalrymen's last moments by looking at the battlefield and those markers. Miles Keough was in command of Company I of the 7th Cavalry. He was said to be the handsomest man in the 7th Cavalry, very dashing in uniform, wearing his buckskin coat. I think Custer would have disputed that claim, but Libby Custer was very fond of Miles Keough, as some would say. Miles Keough was actually wounded in the leg during the fighting at the Little Bighorn. It's not sure whether he fell off his horse or was helped off his horse, but he and his command were found in sort of a last stand, and his remains were found surrounded by his command. They all died together. Most of the bodies at the Little Bighorn cavalrymen were mutilated. Custer went into battle with his brother, Tom Custer, another great, interesting character who earned 2 medals of honor during the Civil War. But people don't really know about him. They know about his brother. His skull was flattened to the density of one's palm. A lot of these cavalrymen were mutilated. Miles Keough was left alone. Now, they say that the reason he was left alone was because some Sioux warriors may have found those medals around his neck and thought they were some sort of magic and left his body alone. Others say that while the Native Americans were on the reservation, some may have converted to the Catholic faith and they recognized the imagery, and so they didn't touch his body. Who knows what the real story is, but those medals, I think, were on auction, I saw on the internet, for some exorbitant amount of money. But there are some great images of him wearing those medals that may have preserved his body at the end. A neat story, I guess I could say, about Company I and Miles Keough is I do like the story of Miles Keough. As you can tell, I'm pretty fond of him. Cimarron Firearms, they produce a lot of cowboy action firearms, and they did produce a cavalry model single action army revolver as a tribute to the 7th Cavalry, and every revolver they produced had stamped on the handle a company that was part of the Custer column. Wow. Company F, Company C. I was able to purchase one of those replica revolvers for myself. They're technically made in Italy, so I say it's my spaghetti western revolver, but it just so happened that the stamped on mine was Company I. So that was just like a sign, like, ah, Miles Keough is here. You know, great. But that was how Miles Keough met his sad end. But interesting that his medals from the Pope had an impact in the end, too.
They did. They did. So I'll quickly mention Henry Fieldham.
Yes.
after the war, he goes back to Britain, actually gets a commission in the Royal Artillery, and then actually goes on the British Arctic Expedition. A lot of people know him for that service because he actually was a naturalist and did a lot of natural sciences work. He was recommended but not let into the Royal Society, but he was a member of the Royal Geographic Society and had kind of this second life that people know him for. One of the most famous examples of this is that reminds me of this is there's a figure named Lane Fox, who I've talked about before, is the musketry instructor for the School of Musketry with the British Army. He actually trains a lot of the British soldiers in Malta before the war even starts, and they actually send him to Canada in preparation for a potential war during the Trent Affair. So he's a professional soldier, is super involved in the creation of the School of Musketry and the building of professional musketry in the British Army, and yet he leaves the army and has this whole second career as an anthropologist and a collector. And when he assumes his title, he becomes Lord Pitt Rivers. And we know him as Lane Fox, and yet he's famous in natural history for having all this very eclectic collection of pieces from all over the world. And there's actually in Oxford, next to the Natural History Museum, is the Pitt Rivers Museum. And I went in and then asked them, do you have any images or anything relating to Pitt Rivers? And they're like, this is the Pitt Rivers. To Lane Fox, to the actual Lord Pitt Rivers. And they had a reference to him in one of the displays, but that was a past life. They didn't mention his military service. And so Henry Fielden is kind of the same way. He's personal friends with Kipling. But he serves in both the First and the Second Boer War. Not very exciting tasks, though, in the Second Boer War. He's the paymaster. He's definitely a staff officer, but because he's a staff officer, he meets so many of these interesting characters. But yeah, personal friend of Kipling. I mentioned Polignac was in the Franco-Prussian War, and then shall we talk about Sir Percy, or shall we talk about the Khedive?
Do you want to save Percy as your final one?
Fine, we'll do Percy at the end. So let me just set the stage. So the Khedive in the early 19th century, Egypt kind of asserts itself. And so even though it's nominally part of the Ottoman Empire, the Egyptians basically operate as their own country. And so the Khedive, they elevate themselves from a wali to a Khedive, basically a viceroy. And the Khedive in Egypt, Ismail Pasha, has a lot of money. And then Egypt has actually started making more money because they're producing a lot more cotton, because somewhere in the world, they're not making as much cotton, and they're not shipping it out. For some reason, there's something going on.
Yes.
And so both India and Egypt start producing more cotton. Egypt, being independent at the time, starts actually making money from that. And Ismail Pasha starts getting more weapons and more officers to actually modernize the Egyptian army. And so about 50 Americans in total from both sides go over to serve the Khedive. And it's actually from a personal recommendation from Sherman that all of these people are picked. There are French and British, even Prussian officers that serve with the Khedive, but they're famously they're Americans. And this is my British bias, but a lot of the Americans take all the wrong lessons from the Civil War and apply them in Egypt. So they bring all of these troops there, and one of the most senior is William Loring. And Loring had been a general in the Confederate service, so now he's obviously going to be a general in the Egyptian service. They actually place an Egyptian in charge of the Egyptian army. Shocking. And Loring's kind of offended by that, but they make him the chief of staff. And so begins, once they have a little bit of training, Washington Carroll Tevis is actually one of the people that's brought in for the training aspect of things. But the Egyptian-Ethiopian War begins in the 1870s, sometimes referred to as the Egyptian-Abyssinian War. But they bring in all these Americans, and they go on this campaign. There's a big campaign into Ethiopia, and it is a tremendous, horrible disaster. I've been reading Loring's account of it, and he has a whole different take on things, but a lot of the Egyptian sources say they were at this battle, they were in a fortress and the enemy was outside the fortress. And so Lauren kind of bullied them into meeting them in the field, where they were then horribly defeated. It comes with that that mentality of, you know, we have to get that victory right now. Give them the bayonet.
Yeah.
Do the methodical war. That's a European thing. American ingenuity is going to get it done. And so Loring still has a good reputation after that and continues in the Egyptian service. And then as the money runs out, they start letting go of so many of these officers, especially after the disaster of the Abyssinian War. And Loring actually goes back to Florida after serving in Egypt. And he's the one of all of these figures that has recently been in the news, because behind the Florida State House, he has a monument, and he was buried under the monument.
Ah.
And it's actually a big obelisk in recognition of his Ottoman service. And it mentions that he worked for the Egyptians, was a major general, had the Order of Osmania and the Order of Majiddi, and was an actual accomplished soldier on two continents. But recently it's been seen as another one of the Confederate monuments. It had a difficult time because he was physically buried there.
Yeah.
And there are a lot of laws protecting graves that don't apply to monuments, but it was relocated. So it wasn't destroyed.
Okay.
And it wasn't taken down in a protest, but they did decide to move it safely. And so I'm glad that it was moved safely and relocated.
The grave was moved as well, or just the...
The obelisk and remains, yeah.
And remains, yeah. Okay, yeah. That must have been a hell of an engineering feat.
It was on the grounds of the State House, and part of it was in on a university, so they decided to move it for political reasons.
Yeah.
And then it was relocated. So it wasn't destroyed. It should be in a cemetery. There's still an ongoing debate about it, but I think it's interesting that they went with the obelisk kind of in homage to his service.
With him, wasn't there Henry Hopkins Sibley, right?
And, at least in the Civil War and the reenacting world, they know Sibley from the Sibley tent. The
right.
round tent is his patent, but Sibley was there. There were quite a few people that were there, but Loring was the one accused of making the blunders.
Right. Well, I mean, I remember vaguely reading, I could be wrong, but I know for sure when Sibley commanded that New Mexico campaign, which was quite a wild campaign, which was the background for A Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Yes.
Reading accounts about that, there was a lot of times where he really wasn't in command because he'd been drinking a lot. I don't know if that drinking may have affected him over there, though.
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's one of those things that it could be just to blur his name. I mean, there's so many instances where Grant, where people are saying he's drinking even though he's not drinking. Right. And I still do not claim to know what happened with Loring or any of the other Confederates or Union soldiers in Egyptian service. I just know that they might not have been bringing the professionalism that they thought they were bringing.
That's fair. Very diplomatic.
And in fairness to them, I think the Egyptian army was not what they were used to working with either.
No, yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And it was a really difficult set of conditions. I mean, other countries have had a hard time fighting in Ethiopia. The Italians get absolutely destroyed just 10 years later in Ethiopia. So it's a difficult set of circumstances, but I'm not sure whether they got their money's worth by hiring Confederates.
Well, you have taken us pretty far out. I'm going to reel us back in here to talk about Mexico and good old Emperor Maximilian there.
Okay.
So if we go back to one of my final characters, Prince Felix, the end of the war, even though he's offered command in the regular army, turns it down, as I said, and he decides to go assist Emperor Maximilian. He's actually made aide-de-camp and chief of the household. That's what high regard the emperor had for him. And he was actually right beside the emperor when the Juaristas finally capture Maximilian. But before that, during the conflict, he was actually in command of the elite cazadores, and they were a wild wild bunch, and he talks about how they were just constantly fighting each other, and on the battlefield it was hard to maintain order because even the bugle boys were trying to outdo the next man with their shots and heroics. But I did want to read this quick little snippet of his service where he's actually tasked with capturing a parrot gun that the Juaristas have. And I'll read it first, but there's a couple reasons why I wanted to mention this. So this is just before the attack, and he says, "I thought it well to address my impatient boys and made a speech to them still more effective than any of those with which I once encouraged my soldiers in the United States, then in broken English, and now in still more broken Spanish. I told them that I did not want to hear a shot until I ordered it and that the main business had to be done with the bayonet. I then formed them for the attack, keeping them under cover as long as possible. While I did so, my men actually quivered with eagerness, like a pack of hounds waiting for the signal. With a tremendous cheer in as many languages as were spoken around the Tower of Babel, and a Viva el Emperador, they stormed the bridge and rode before it. When they had reached about the middle of the place, we received a shower of canister at a distance of 50 paces and discovered the dangerous parrot before us. I raised my sword and calling out, Viva el Emperador, a la pieza muchachos, we rushed up to the gun. Gave liberal commander of the gun, a lieutenant, fired at the major with his revolver and wounded him severely, but it was with his last shot. Half a dozen bayonets were immediately buried in his body. All the artillerymen belonging to the rifled cannon were bayoneted or killed with the stock of the guns used like clubs, and the conquered piece was sent back to the bridge." He goes on and he talks about how there were many French members in his unit that were infuriated by the butchery at San Jacinto, and they found many Frenchmen fighting with the liberals, he says, and they had no mercy on those other Frenchmen that were on the opposite side. He even says here, "One of my sergeants, a Frenchman, had killed in a house four Mexican. A fifth man, a Frenchman, was on his knees praying for mercy. His conqueror, in charging his musket, said, 'All the mercy I will grant you is this, that I will not dispatch you like a dog, but give you the honor of a bullet.' With that, he very calmly shot his countryman dead." So the reason I wanted to read that, besides being very colorful and a lot of action, is here we are again, another conflict. We've got Frenchmen. We've got Felix, who admits that he cannot speak English, nor can he speak Spanish, and he's leading these men. And he mentions that everyone is yelling, you know, "Long live the Emperor," in a multitude of different languages. So these soldiers of fortune are coming from all over the place. They find another home here in Mexico in another conflict. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And the fact that the parrot is most likely from the United States. So there are several, he mentions in his book that several Americans were in the conflict as well, fighting for the opposite side.
In Mexico?
Actually, he survives that. He survives, okay. And he actually ends up, he does die in combat, but in the Franco-Prussian War.
Okay.
So he does survive all of that and dies back in Europe. But it's very interesting because there were several times where he tried his best to, and so did his wife, to rescue the emperor, but to no avail. The emperor is ultimately executed by firing squad, so.
So, do you have any more figures that we need to cover?
I guess in just the last one for me, I'll say before we do our deep dive into your last one, right?
Yeah.
Just George DuPont, again, from Siam, serves in the Civil War, is discharged 1865, finds it hard returning back to civilian life, and he ends up going back to Siam and serving as in their army as an instructor. So sort of what Loring did. And he ends up dying in 1900 and is buried in Bangkok. Not so adventurous, but definitely takes us to another part of the globe that we haven't really touched on yet. So
that's fascinating. So the one part that I think it is one of the great podcast cliches to mention that it's going to be another podcast, but
yeah.
On another podcast, I'd like to talk about the naval volunteers.
Okay.
I didn't mention them today because, you know, that's a whole other episode, that there was European service in the navies on both sides.
The Civil War Navy just doesn't get enough attention. I think we do deserve to give the Navy its own episode. Yeah. I mean, it's about time, really.
Yeah. So I'll now mention Sir Percy. So Sir Percy, actually, there's a bit of a defamation, a bit of a an accusation that he is a bit of a fraud in the middle of the Civil War, that, you know, he's marching around calling himself Sir, and some people in Britain that actually say, that write about this, and he has this famous quote where he says, "Some men make a name for themselves, others die contemplating the parents who gave them their name. And I think that kind of sums up Sir Percy. You know, he doesn't want to continue in the life that he was given in Britain, and he wants to make a name for himself however he can do that. And that must be a lot of these people willing to travel across oceans to fight in the Civil War. But he goes, he leaves in 1864. He actually organizes the defense of Washington during one of Lee's invasions. He actually gathers a bunch of cavalrymen for the defense of Washington. But in 1864, he leaves the army, and in 1865 goes to the Royal Italian Army back to Italy and works for the Royal Italian Army. And then in 1879, he goes to India. There's not much on his Indian service, but you ended in Siam, and I'm going to end in Burma.
There you go.
I'm going to read from his obituary, because his death is as fantastic as his life. Thrown from a balloon. News of a sad accident comes from Rangoon. Colonel Percy Wyndham, a gentleman well known in Calcutta and Rangoon, announced an ascent in a balloon of his own construction. After attaining the height of about 500 feet, the balloon burst, and the unfortunate aeronaut fell into the Royal Lake, whence he was extricated quite dead. Colonel Percy Wyndham was a distinguished soldier of fortune. He served with great credit under General Garibaldi and the Northern Army during the American War. He came to Calcutta some years ago, where he established a successful comic paper. Then he became impresario of the opera. Next, he entered the services of the King of Burma as commander-in-chief. Soon, however, quarreling with that potentate, he went to Rangoon, where his characteristic death closed a career more checkered than falls the lot of many in this commonplace age. Sir Percy Wyndham, soldier of fortune, impresario of the opera, and failed balloonist. You can't make that up.
No. As you said in the other episode, the truth is always far stranger, far more interesting than the fiction. Yeah. We can't even imagine some of this stuff. It's just the reality of it. And I think that's a great note to end on right there. So thank you for coming on the podcast. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun. I was really eager to do this one. And, you know, I'm doing it with the right person right here.
Yeah.
So until next time, thank you.
All right. Well, thanks for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that episode while sitting at your local coffee shop, standing in line for your rations, chipping a tooth on that hardtack, or whenever you listen to podcasts. Thank you again to Craig Duncan for the use of his music. And also, give us a 5-star review on iTunes, if so inclined. We'd love to hear from you. If you wish to support the show, please download the app Gettysburg, A Nation Divided with the code UNTOLDCIVILWAR with no spaces. A portion of your app purchase will support the show with no extra cost to you. You can also support us by following us on Instagram and liking us on Facebook. Thank you for your interest in Untold Civil War. I hope you tune in next time for our next episode.